throne. It hadn't. This time, the interruption was not caused by an unruly crowd member. This time, the interruption was caused by the most intense pain Dan McCarthy had ever felt. He fell to the ground, clasping his neck in an open-mouthed silence born of his agonized inability to scream. In the space of the 3 seconds it took Clark to register what had happened and turn back towards the stairs in preparation of a desperate sprint up to the stage, the worst pain of Dan's life had passed, gone as rapidly as it had come. Almost instantly, Dan was sitting up and gazing into the distance. His mouth was still open, but the pained expression was gone, replaced by one of absolute incredulity. The crowd gasped, yelled, and murmured. Many reporters fled in all directions, and some stood frozen in amazement. Clark looked away from Dan and out towards the crowd. Above them, he saw an uncloaked alien craft approaching from the area behind Hawker's Hill. It looked exactly like the craft Trey had recorded flying low over Lolo, with only one crucial difference. This time, the craft wasn't flying over anywhere. This time, it was landing at the edge of the Birchwood Drive-In. C+39. McKinley Dwyer Hospital, Colorado Springs, Colorado. Seconds after enduring a brief but almost impossibly intense sensation in her neck, Emma Ford was sitting bolt upright for the first time since the attack at Fiore Frontieri. A doctor responding to Tara's second call for help, the first having come during the far milder twinge which awakened Emma prior to Dan's extensive rundown of the IDA hoax, arrived in Emma's room as quickly as he could. He saw that she was sitting up and looking as fresh as a daisy, took one glance at the supporting readings on the bedside equipment, and then turned towards the TV to see what she and Tara were so utterly entranced by. For the life of him, he couldn't believe what he saw.
"Is that?"
"Yeah," Emma said, beaming widely without turning away.
"He did it."
Staring at a bona fide alien craft just a few miles from the hospital and having missed most of Dan's speech, the doctor neither shared nor understood Emma's joy. Tara, meanwhile, watched on with some degree of trepidation. She understood the desperation behind Dan's actions and supported what he had done, but she couldn't help but fixate on the part of the story about the messenger's repeatedly expressed desire for the hoax to stay under the carpet. Unilaterally, Dan had brought everything out into the light. Tara kept her concerns to herself, hoping beyond hope that the aliens would be surprised rather than angry. C+40. Drive-In, Birchwood, Colorado. The drive-in descended into absolute chaos as a discus-like alien craft gracefully landed just beyond the entrance gate. A small ramp then rapidly extended from the craft's main body to the ground, causing many of those in its vicinity to follow the countless others who had already fled in terror. It was a small craft, its diameter appearing no greater than the length of a commercial jet, and it rested flat on the ground. Both of these physical characteristics placed it in stark contrast to the enormous mothership-like craft Dan had encountered in Lolo National Forest, which had dominated the valley and rested upon a retractable metallic pillar at an odd angle. In the seconds before the visitors from another world emerged from their vessel, a question crossed Dan's mind. What if these aren't the same ones? Around a third of those present in the drive-in were already gone, running as fast and as far as they could. Dan looked beyond those who remained and watched disbelievingly as two bipedal aliens, side by side, smoothly walked down their gently angled ramp and touched down on Earth. Even across the full distance of the drive-in lot, he could tell it was them. The messengers stopped at the base of their ramp, both of their gazes trained firmly on Dan. Some reporters flashed their cameras, while the largest number yet turned and ran to join those who had already fled. The aliens, just as Dan remembered, wore a seamless white fabric, which covered all of their bluish-silver skin, other than their bulbous heads and slender hands. Those reporters brave enough to have remained near the ramp could now make out the large primate-like eyes which dominated the messengers' neotenous faces. One of the messengers raised a hand. It was composed of two wide, finger-like divisions and one highly dexterous thumb. And at this, the remaining mass of humanity within the drive-in lot immediately began dividing into two sections. Dan watched as everyone else directly in front of the messengers, including Clark, covered their ears and ran one way or the other. Force fields, Dan realized. They're clearing a path. Even the assailant, who Clark had flattened with a stiff blow, now rose to his feet and stumbled out of the otherwise deserted zone as quickly as he could, leaving a totally empty area between Dan's elevated position and the two messengers. Some cameras and other recording equipment littered the area, but the intensity of the sound waves within the zone prevented anyone from trying to get back in. Anyone that was, except for Clark, who gritted his teeth and made a laudable effort to reach the stairs and protect Dan. But for the first time in Clark's life, pain truly got the better of him. The intensity of the sensation he experienced on the wrong side of the threshold forced him to retreat and left him standing helplessly at the edge of the vacant walkway along with everyone else, stuck on the outside looking in. Even more clearly than had been the case at Lolo, this force field was explicitly marked by the effect it had on those who tried to cross it. And while the walkway was relatively narrow, perhaps only 15 feet in width, Dan's perspective made it impossible not to think of Moses and the crossing of the Red Sea. As the messengers began walking towards Dan, he made his way down the stairs and took a few tentative steps towards them. When he was past the first of the abandoned cameras, he knew that he alone was permitted on this side of the mysterious threshold. He stopped again and watched the expressionless messengers walking slowly but steadily towards him. They were here. They were really here. Dan's expression, however, was not the most welcoming. They were here a day after Timo and Emma had almost been blown to pieces. They were here weeks after indirectly warning Dan of an approaching comet without doing anything to help humanity deal with it. They were here far too goddamn late. "Where were you yesterday?" Dan yelled, the anger boiling over in his voice and expression. "You can come to stop Walker from talking, but not to stop Emma and Timo from being blown up? And the comet? Why won't you just stop it? Divert it? Why the hell would you only tell us about it when you know there's nothing we can do about it?" And with that thought, Dan's walk turned into a run. The messengers continued, still expressionless, until Dan came within reach and lunged forward to lash out. At that point, one of the messengers raised a hand, bringing forth a sudden force which pushed Dan backwards through the air and sent him to the ground with a rough thud.
"Vipat la mis loptak so,"
the same messenger vocalized. Its tone fell abruptly at the end of each short and melodic phrase, in precise keeping with the vocal pattern Dan recalled so vividly from his prior meeting with the messengers at Lolo. Dan tried again to lunge forward, displaying a near vitriolic rage at the messengers, which he hadn't expected for one second. But unlike the path-clearing threshold, which Clark had been able to cross for a few seconds, this was a hard barrier more in keeping with the force field Clark had run into, face first, in Richard Walker's house. Dan's hands pushed against the invisible barrier in a manner akin to a performing mime.
"Stop hiding behind your stupid force fields!" he yelled before unthinkingly running towards them again.
Unlike Clark, he had a reason to see the impact coming and should have known better than to collide with the equivalent of an invisible brick wall. But, just like Clark, the collision earned him a bloody and likely broken nose. Dan fell backwards, clasping his face, before pushing himself to his feet once more and staring at the approaching aliens with fury in his eyes. Dan's injury prompted Clark to dash forward again, momentarily forgetting the ear-splitting pain he would bring upon himself by doing so. As before, he only made it a few steps. The same messenger that had created the initial force field then held an open palm towards Clark, freezing him to the spot on the safe side of the threshold. Clark couldn't talk, but the awkwardness of his stance and the utterly static expression on his face left no one in any doubt that he had been involuntarily immobilized. Reacting to this, an attendant police officer attempted to raise his firearm in the messenger's direction, but found his hand unable to grasp it. He, too, was frozen and silenced, but no one was paying enough attention to notice. As he looked across the drive-in lot in the direction of his helpless brother, Dan couldn't believe his eyes.
"What the hell are you doing?" he yelled at the messengers. What are you? Mid-word, Dan's body was similarly paralyzed by the same messenger's outward-facing palm. He tried to move and tried to talk, but nothing happened. He could look around and he could blink. His eye muscles were unaffected, but that was the full extent of the physical control he could now exert over his own body.
Lesh Namti Ku,
the messenger said, its sing-song-like tone somehow soothing Dan's intense discomfort.
Benoslad Hik.
The second messenger then placed its hand on the leader's back. Footage would later reveal that it was reaching into a small pouch-like opening in the apparently seamless fabric of the full-body garment and produced a thin metallic cable. Dan knew what was coming next, but the moment when the cable was connected to the back of his neck was far more painful than last time. He couldn't move or talk, but he could certainly feel, and never in his life had he felt anything like this. Many of the remaining crowd, terrified of what they were seeing, could no longer look. But when the leading messenger connected the other end of the cable to its own hand, all of Dan's pain disappeared. The world disappeared. Now it seemed like there was nothing in the world but him and the extraterrestrial being which stood not 3 feet from his face. C plus 41. Unknown location, unknown place. Be calm. Dan McCarthy was standing in the Birchwood drive-in, but he truly felt as though he was nowhere. Time and space were nothing. The only thing in the world was the messenger standing before him. And immediately, just after 2 words, Dan realized that he could hear this messenger's thoughts far more clearly than he'd been able to last time. He had already noticed that the cable was smaller, and it now seemed apparent that the communication interface had been greatly refined. Like the out loud alien vocalizations he and Emma had heard on the craft at Lolo, Dan had written extensive notes on the nature of the pseudo-verbal two-way communication he had experienced. He had heard everything in his own mental accent, as though conversing with himself or recalling thoughts that weren't his own. During that first conversation a year earlier, he had grown into the flow of it and come to realize that asking questions with yes or no answers was the best way to get a reply that wasn't a jumbled collection of thoughts he would struggle to comprehend. But this time, already, it seemed very different. Still, the alien's words came to Dan as though he himself was thinking them. There was effortless clarity, however, where once there had been a cloud of confusion. That was our first ever direct communication. Improved understanding of human brain activity and speech processing through analysis of the first attempt has improved our interface. You can say that again, Dan replied. Strictly speaking, it was a thought rather than a reply, but in this situation the terms were atypically synonymous. The relatively long but perfectly clear thought he had just heard from the messenger, these really were the only inexact terms in which his human mind could frame it, was markedly more vivid than any he had heard at Lolo. But where the hell have you been? He pushed. We recognize that the path of the comet is highly unfortunate. And? And this is why we alerted you of the path of the comet. We recognize that it is highly unfortunate. This is why we alerted you. Stop repeating the same thing, Dan said, again feeling as though he was saying the words while actually only thinking them, but now starting to wonder just how improved the interface actually was. He would take repetitive and clunky over vague and evasive any day of the week, however, so he continued on the path of asking questions more complicated and direct than the yes or no kind he'd had to settle for at Lolo. Why didn't you just divert it? This is an extremely complicated intervention. No, it's not. We could do it if we had the tech. Kinetic bombardment and gravity tractors might sound complicated, but you're telling me that slightly changing the course of a comet is more complicated than making force fields? You're telling me it's more complicated than freezing people to the spot? It is complicated in a regulatory sense, not difficult in a practical sense. Regulatory? Dan asked, starting to get the impression that some of the words and phrases he was hearing weren't entirely precise, almost like those he'd encountered during attempts to translate Spanish sentences one word at a time while studying for school exams. This time, of course, the linguistic chasm between his native language and the messenger's was more than a little wider. What does that even mean?
We have intervened to assist as fully as we were permitted to do so. We led you to the plaque and showed you the comet's path. We flew this small, uncloaked craft overhead and allowed a recording to be made. We have intervened to assist as fully as we were permitted to do so.
So, what was the point of flying over Lolo? What was that supposed to achieve?
To confirm the relevance of that particular location in your search for the plaque's location.
But Trey only had to see it. Why did you let him record it without doing the stupid interference thing you usually do? And why mention that, as if it makes any difference to anything?
Camera interference may have prevented others from accepting that you were correct about guiding them to the plaque.
What are you talking about? What others? Dan asked. Everyone? Or Clark and Emma? Because they already knew, and who cares? Just stop the comet.
We wanted to give you an option.
Option? So now you suddenly care about giving us options? You really want to talk about options? How about the comet? How about leaving us with no options, with no chance to save ourselves? Why didn't you just move it without telling us? How does what you did make any kind of sense? You caused way more disruption than you would have if you just diverted it at the beginning. You think all this crap was less of an intervention?
Even in the heat of the moment, Dan wondered whether the number of questions he had asked at once would result in some being lost in the shuffle, or none at all being understood.
Why did you tell us but not save us? He asked, focusing on the gist of it.
In regulatory terms, the physical intervention of altering a cometary body's orbit is
enough with the regulatory bullshit, Dan interrupted. And all this minimal intervention stuff is your rule. You made it so you can break it.
It was not easy to justify our warning as a necessary intervention. We pushed for further permission to intervene directly, but influencing the orbit of a cometary body alters its effects on other bodies. Altering those effects, even slightly, was deemed beyond a reasonably minimal level of intervention in the views of the elders. This is the source of our regulatory difficulty.
Elders? Dan asked. More than with any other specific word he had heard so far, he got the feeling that this wasn't an exact translation of the term the messenger was trying to get across. Do you report to these elders? Do these elders decide what kind of intervention you can make? Are they your leaders? Your regulatory leaders?
Yes. To all questions, yes.
I want to see them. Take me to the elders.
Out of the question. It would not be physically possible.
Then ask them this for me. Why did they let you come here today and show yourselves now but not last year? Why didn't you just arrive and tell everyone you were peaceful?
The elders recently insisted that open contact could only occur when the truth about certain human-driven issues came to light. The elders deemed that humanity's confusion about the true nature of our existence was an obstacle to peaceful contact.
Hold the show, Dan said, disbelieving what he was hearing. Are you actually telling me that your elders wanted everyone to know that the stuff we fell for last year was fake? Seriously? If they wanted the hoax to get out, then why the hell did you stop Walker when you did? He was going to spill everything that night.
He was the source of the confusion. There was a firm edict that he must not be allowed to further cloud.
But he wouldn't have been clouding anything, Dan interrupted, essentially cutting off one thought with another. He was trying to clear it all up.
That was the edict.
Although Dan had been looking directly into the messenger's eyes for almost all of the conversation so far, his gaze suddenly intensified. Put him back, he demanded.
He was very ill. He did not survive the removal from Earth.
Put him back, Dan repeated. Dead or not, you're going to put him back.
Yes, he is dead. So why do you want...
We might not be perfect, Dan butted in, but we lay our dead to rest, even him. I don't care how much trouble he caused for you or how much trouble he caused for me. And when Crab sees that there's no body at Walker's place, then what? Everyone will know you took him away. Is that what you want?
For the first time, the fact that the messengers or their elders apparently hadn't considered the issue of Walker's missing body firmly planted a seed in Dan's mind that they really didn't understand humanity nearly as well as he had always assumed. They hadn't thought about what Crab would or wouldn't find, and they didn't seem to have any concept of a funeral.
He will be returned, but he is not alive.
You already said that, Dan replied. Anyway, thank you. But I still don't understand why you stopped him.
We had an edict to silence him, but that was before humanity knew of the comet. That was also before we knew that some humans would try to sabotage other humans' defensive measures. That was something we did not expect.
Then you really don't know us very well, Dan said.
Today, due to the truth now being clear among humans, we were permitted to return. We are now permitted to offer direct instruction on possible methods of disrupting the comet in an effort to...
No, screw your possible methods, Dan snapped. His mind was now firmly on the galling point that Clark had forcefully made on several occasions, so he took the only chance he would ever have to raise it in a situation where it could possibly make any difference.
And you've got some brass neck talking about sabotaging our defensive measures. If you hadn't destroyed DS-1 seconds after it launched, maybe we would have had a chance.
Instructions are no good. We don't have time, and in case you haven't noticed, our society isn't exactly doing very well at dealing with this. If you wanted to give us instructions, why weren't they on the fourth plaque?
Where were you with these instructions when I went to the cornfield with Emma, begging you to show up?
Where were you then, before everything went to total shit and before it was too late for instructions to be of any goddamn use to anyone?
None of this had to happen. I was trying to talk to you. We were trying to talk to you.
For once, no reply came Dan's way. He saw a slight movement on the messenger's typically expressionless face as its primate-like eyes widened slightly, as though it was now having to think rather than respond automatically.
See, you didn't think of that, did you? Your genius elders decided to let you destroy DS-1, an intervention which created tension within the GSC and set us back years, but for some reason they've decided that now's the time to take a hard line against any more major interventions, even to undo the damage you did last time.
The risk of unintended consequences is precisely why we intervene minimally, as a rule. However, given the unforeseen effect of the initial intervention in this case... In another first, the messenger's communication stopped mid-thought. It seemed to Dan almost as though it was again thinking in a manner the cable couldn't relay, or perhaps that it was silently communicating with its companion.
Hano-san, ni...
It called out loud, disproving Dan's suspicion of silent communication.
Mano plen fum.
In response to this comment, the second messenger turned towards the craft and extended its hand, holding out its two thick finger-like appendages as though sending or receiving a message. 15 or 20 long seconds later, it lowered its hand and replied in a slightly deeper but similarly melodic tone.
Babilo. V. Yeptan Sal Kalu.
The messenger in front of Dan then finished its earlier thought. In this case, a corrective intervention, even one of some astronomical significance, has been approved. It is approved.
It was now Dan's turn to be lost for words. How fast do these elders operate? He wondered to himself. If all of his facial muscles, other than his eyelids, hadn't been frozen in place, his mouth would have been agape, and his eyebrows raised.
"So you're going to stop it?" he eventually asked. "You're really going to do it?"
"Not stop. Divert."
"I meant stop it from hitting us," Dan qualified. "I couldn't give a rat's ass where else it goes."
"Yes, it is done." In the face of this most casual confirmation that the messengers, or their elders, would indeed intervene to save Earth, Dan was almost too surprised to be pleased, too flabbergasted for the magnitude of what he had just been told to truly sink in.
"Slow down," he said. "Rewind. I want to get this right. You couldn't come here and show yourselves until humanity understood the full truth about what was real and what wasn't. Is that right? For now, I'll even ignore all the reasons you gave me to think that you actively wanted me to keep quiet about the hoax. I just want to check that I've got this right so far."
"You have got this right so far."
"Okay. And directly influencing a comet is something you weren't allowed to do, but you'll be allowed to do it now that your leaders understand that a planet of 7 billion intelligent and mostly peaceful beings would otherwise be wiped out,
all because you destroyed its best chance of defending itself the last time you were there.
Yes. Essentially, yes. If it had been able to move, Dan's head would have been shaking in disbelief.
So if I hadn't told everyone about the hoax, you wouldn't have come back? And even once you were here, if I hadn't reminded you that our being so unprepared was pretty much your fault, your friend here wouldn't have been able to make that case to whoever makes the regulatory decisions, and they wouldn't have said yes?
Essentially, yes.
And what about Emma? Dan asked, immediately shifting focus with no time to celebrate.
Her condition does not seem serious. It is not a serious concern.
That's not what the doctors say.
It will not be a permanent concern. She will recover. And Timo.
For some reason, it surprised Dan to hear a name, even though he knew he was hearing the messenger's thoughts in his own mental accent, and even though the messengers had obviously been watching everything closely enough to know who was who. But why didn't you intervene before they got hurt? He asked. Did you know it wouldn't be serious? Permanent, I mean?
No. We did not know that. But the situation was not of the kind which merits intervention.
Dan didn't like this answer, but in one sense he respected it. It would have been easy enough for the messenger to lie. How early did you know that the comet was on course to hit Earth? He asked, changing the subject.
Just before the Kerguelen bolide.
Dan was grateful to learn that they had started trying to warn him right away, as soon as they knew there was something to warn him about. But this really did settle it in his mind that the messengers weren't the supreme and all-knowing beings he once thought. And in light of the methods they had chosen to alert humanity of the comet, he reflected that, not entirely dissimilarly to himself, they had spent the last few weeks trying to understand a distant species which was equipped with vaguely similar physiology, but vastly different psychology. The messenger could hear these thoughts, of course, and in reply it dispassionately defended its species' abilities.
Our cross-cultural communications and understandings are continually improving.
Cross-cultural was another word that felt particularly inexact. But Dan knew what it was getting at. He didn't give this much thought, anyway. His mind was now too busy considering the bigger picture. His anger towards the messengers for not intervening earlier had now turned to a more blameless kind of disappointment, but even that paled in comparison to the relief that was belatedly sinking in. Thanks to the messengers, Earth was safe. They weren't all-knowing, and they weren't perfect, but they were here. They were here. They had traveled untold miles out of their way, and they were here for no reason other than to help. As Dan looked into the intelligent but emotionless eyes of the messenger before him, he felt a sudden flood of gratitude joining relief in his body and mind. A reply quickly came to this thought, which he hadn't consciously shared, but which the messenger had picked up loud and clear.
When we can help, we do what we can.
Whether this was a perfect translation or not, it struck Dan as a perfect summation of a laudable philosophy.
We will now remove the cable.
Are you ever coming back? Dan asked.
Only if necessary.
This was better than no answer at all, but Dan pushed for more. What would make it necessary? Nuclear war? Another comet or asteroid? Some kind of massive terrestrial disaster?
Each instance will be judged on its own merits, but planetary independence and peaceful technological progress is greatly encouraged. I will now remove the cable.
Are you going to take out or disable whatever it is that makes my neck hurt when you're close, and Emma's? And how come she didn't feel it the first time? Is hers less sensitive than mine? Were you further away when you caused the Kerguelen bolide than you were for the other interventions, and she only feels it if you're slightly closer? No answers came to these final questions as the messenger moved behind Dan's still immobilized body. The conversation was clearly over, and there wasn't a lot he could do about it. As soon as the cable came out, his body relaxed, and he stumbled backwards before quickly catching his balance. Then, very surprisingly, the messenger extended its hand in a sign of peace, just like it had seen humans do. So soon after being forcibly frozen on the spot, Dan wasn't exactly feeling overly friendly towards the messenger, despite its promise of a better late than never comet intervention. After glancing around the concerned faces on those brave enough to have remained in the drive-in lot, however, he was aware enough of the world around him to know that everyone everywhere would see this moment,
most of them live on TV, and the rest before long. Dan couldn't have possibly imagined the messianic pedestal he would be placed on by some in the days and weeks to come, but he was conscious of the unprecedented position of responsibility he had fallen into as humanity's sole point of contact with an intelligent extraterrestrial race. He imagined Emma standing on the other side of the force field, which was still keeping people on either side of the wide walkway, and he knew exactly what two words she would have been mouthing his way. Game face. With that in mind, Dan McCarthy stood up straight with his shoulders back, looked firmly into the messenger's eyes, and shook its hand. Some people cheered, while most continued to watch in stunned silence. The messenger turned away, beckoning its companion to follow its lead and setting off down the otherwise vacant walkway. A thinned herd of brave humans, still pressed as tightly to either side of that walkway as they could be, then watched on in awe as the messengers re-entered their craft without so much as a backwards glance. Dan saw that Clark was no longer frozen either, but he was still stuck on the other side of the force field. He no longer looked as concerned as he had at first, since Dan was now free to move around, but he clearly wanted to reach him. As Dan watched the alien craft take off, he suddenly felt extremely drowsy. Intense stomach pains then hit, of a kind he vaguely remembered from when he woke up next to Emma after their shared contact experience at Lolo. Both had been physically ill on that occasion, and Dan thought that the same thing wasn't far away now. Next came a dull pain in his neck, not as sudden or intense as previous twinges, but a somehow heavier kind of sensation that forced him to his knees. Now, he felt sick. He saw the craft flying away over his head, higher and higher in a steady ascent. A police officer in the crowd was yelling about how he, too, had been frozen to the spot, but few were looking in his direction. Dan then looked back down and saw Clark running towards him across the now traversable lot. But before Clark arrived, Dan lost consciousness. In full view of countless reporters, most of whose cameras were naturally focused on the departing alien craft, Dan McCarthy lay collapsed in the center of the Birchwood drive-in, truly exhausted in every sense of the word. C plus 42. GSC Headquarters, Buenos Aires, Argentina. William Godfrey had no clue what the remarkable events in Birchwood would mean for his future as GSC chairman, or indeed for the future of the GSC itself, but right now that seemed like just about the least important thing in the world. Even for the power-driven Godfrey, the sight of two bona fide extraterrestrials not merely landing on Earth, but communicating with a human being in front of the media's cameras, was one which transcended political concerns. Despite the personal embarrassment of being so utterly bamboozled, Godfrey also couldn't help but tip his hat to the Machiavellian genius of Richard Walker's elaborate hoax, which had, after all, taken in the rest of the world just as fully as it had taken in Godfrey. In the few hours since the contact site had been cleared and secured by U.S. federal agents, excited reports had come from lower floors of the GSC headquarters. The conclusion was understandably tentative, given the huge distance and the short period of time involved, but the personnel responsible for tracking Comet Conte Abate were insistent that the small orbital deviation they had already detected was unprecedented and highly significant. If they were correct, the comet's course had changed and would no longer carry it to a collision with Earth. If they were correct, the messengers had indeed decisively intervened. Godfrey gazed at the TV screen as it showed yet another repeat of the incredible moments when a statue-like Dan McCarthy had been connected to one of the messengers by a metallic cable at the back of his neck. It was by now assumed as a fact that Dan and the alien had been conversing, and the data Godfrey was privy to, but which hadn't yet reached the media, gave him a strong clue as to what had been said. "Dan McCarthy," Godfrey said to himself, a rare natural smile crossing his face. "You beautiful bastard." C plus 43. En route, destination unknown. An unknowable amount of time after losing consciousness at the drive-in, Dan McCarthy awoke with a pounding headache,
With no real points of reference for this kind of feeling, all he could liken the sensation to was that of a murderous hangover. He looked down and saw that he was positioned on a plastic stretcher with a thin pillow under his head. What the hell? Several medical sensors were stuck to his skin, hooked up to a screen full of readings, and he was definitely moving in some kind of ground-based vehicle. Despite these typically telltale signs, however, it certainly didn't look or feel like any ambulance he'd ever seen. Seriously? What the hell? Fortunately, Dan's acute panic dissipated when he turned around and saw Clark in the dim light, sitting on the bare floor next to the stretcher.
"It's okay, man," Clark said gently. "Just relax."
Dan carefully pushed himself up to a sitting position and asked the obvious question.
"Where are we going?" "They wouldn't tell me," Clark replied.
"Who wouldn't tell you? Who's driving this thing, GSC guys?"
"It's just the feds," Clark said, far more calmly than Dan could understand. "They closed off the whole drive-in, gave you some sedatives, and did a lot of pathogen tests at the scene. Now they need to question us at this facility we're going to. But listen, man, right now you really need to relax. You've been through a lot, but everything's okay."
"Okay?" Dan echoed. "Okay? What exactly is okay about being sedated and locked in the back of a van without even knowing where it's taking us?"
"Dan, I already talked them into letting me stay with you at all times. I asked if they wanted a mob of thousands of angry people outside every federal building in the country, because that's what they would have gotten if I'd had to post something about you being taken away and held against your will. But listen to me. Sure, these really aren't the kind of people we can say no to, but the fact that they let me stay with you at least tells us that they're not our enemies. I'll be with you the whole time, and they said it's just a few more physical tests and then some questions."
After glancing again at the readings on the screen next to his stretcher, Dan's gaze suddenly shot towards Clark as his mind cleared. "How's Emma?" he blurted out, patting his pocket for a phone that had long ago been confiscated. "When did you last speak to Tara?"
"Yeah, they took everything," Clark said, watching Dan looking around for his phone. "But they let me call Tara before we left. Emma was awake, she's going to be okay, and she saw what happened at the drive-in. Can you remember any of that? Can you remember exactly what they told you?"
Dan was silent for several seconds. The news about Emma was music to his ears, and he could remember everything perfectly. Of course he could. But he knew that his every word was doubtless being listened to and recorded by whoever was driving the vehicle. With this in mind, he didn't want to say too much until he knew what was going on and where he was being taken.
"I'm really tired," he eventually said. "We'll talk about it later."
With these words, the vehicle drew to a gentle halt. Surely, they both thought, this was no coincidence. To confirm this suspicion, a man entered the rear section of the vehicle via a small and previously concealed doorway-like hatch connected to the front. The agent, who looked to be in his late 40s or early 50s, had reddish-blonde hair, freckles, and features far less harsh than Dan would have expected.
"Mr. McCarthy," he said before looking between the brothers and realizing that this wasn't much of a qualifier.
Dan?"
"What?" Dan said, instinctively disconnecting the adhesive sensors from his skin and moving from the stretcher to the security of the spot beside Clark.
"Can you contact them again?"
the man asked, a surprising straightforwardness that bordered on innocence in his voice. Dan chose his words very carefully.
"If they wanted to talk to you, they wouldn't go through me."
"Well, we would very much like to talk to them."
"It takes two to tango," Dan said.
"I'm sure it does," the agent said, giving little away in his expression.
"For now, Dan, if you don't mind, I'd very much like to ask you some questions about what happened earlier today."
Dan shook his head.
"Me first. You answer my questions, and maybe I'll think about answering yours."
The agent held out an upturned palm to invite Dan's questions.
"Although," he said, "I can make no promises that I'll be able to answer them."
"Where are we going?"
Dan asked, wasting no time.
"Unfortunately, I'm not able to. What's your job title?"
The agent took a deep breath. "Again, who do you report to?" This time the only reply Dan got came in the form of a weak sigh.
"You're not very good at this," Dan said. The agent raised his eyebrows and wrinkled his nose in a nervous tick kind of way.
Dan, it will save a lot of time for everyone if you cooperate by answering some questions now so that the physical tests can begin as soon as we arrive.
What physical tests? I haven't agreed to anything.
I can assure you it's nothing invasive, but we have several hours until we arrive, so I want a phone call, Dan said, his demeanor changing instantly.
If I'm going to be in this vehicle for hours, I want a phone call now. And you can tell whoever is driving that I'm not cooperating with anyone or anything until I get it.
The agent looked at Clark, hoping to find some reason.
You heard him, Clark said firmly. One phone call.
Look, if I could give you that, I would. But it's just not possible.
Fine, Dan shrugged.
If that's how you want to play it.
It's not really my decision. If you would just be willing to...
Like I said, Dan spoke over him. Fine. It's you who has to go back to your boss and tell him you failed.
The agent, looking defeated, sulked back through to the front of the vehicle. He hadn't struck Dan as typical of the kind of person he would have expected, and he couldn't help but wonder whether they'd deliberately sent someone so non-threatening to ask the questions and whether their next attempts might not be so gentle. Equally aware of the certainty that their conversations were being recorded, Clark winked at Dan. He was pleased, and more than a little proud of him for holding his ground and showing that he wouldn't be pushed around. While he wanted Dan to cooperate, it was important to have a backbone and show that they wouldn't back down from any plainly stated and reasonable demands. A long, boring drive continued in near silence for almost an hour. Neither brother wanted to say too much until the vehicle drew to another gentle and unexpectedly early halt. Dan's initial assumption that they had arrived proved to be premature when the same non-threatening agent returned through the same doorway-like hatch with a phone in his hand. He gave it to Dan.
One call, he said, trying to sound more intimidating than he was, and make it quick.
Dan grinned. Don't gloat, Clark whispered. Say thanks.
Thanks, Dan said, taking the unfamiliar phone and immediately dialing Tara's number. He had always been effortlessly good at internalizing numbers. This rarely came in handy, but when it did, it did.
Pick up, pick up, pick up, he pleaded, desperately hoping that Tara would be willing to answer a call from an unknown number. He was even more desperate to confirm that Emma was still awake and okay, and as soon as the ringing stopped, he got a positive answer to both concerns. Emma's voice answered, full of hope, despite the unknown number the call was coming in from.
Dan?
Yeah, he said, smiling broadly. Are you okay?
Oh my God, are you? I saw everything.
I'm fine, Dan insisted. But what about you?
Been better, but they say everything is going to get better, so it could be a lot worse. Seriously, though, how are you doing? Where did they take you?
We're still on the way, and I still don't know where to, Dan said. The back of whatever kind of vehicle we're in doesn't have any windows, and they won't tell me anything. They finally gave me a phone call, but only because I said I wouldn't talk to them until they did.
Just cooperate, okay? They're not going to hurt you. Please just do what you have to do to get home.
Dan hesitated.
Dan, promise me you'll get home as soon as you can.
Emma said, the insistent timbre making her sound something more like her normal self. Okay, I promise. And I'll tell you everything the messenger said when I get home. But the main thing is that Il Diavolo shouldn't be a problem anymore. They said that because their initial intervention set us back so far...
You haven't heard?
Emma butted in, genuine surprise in her voice.
Natalia Ricci from Fiori Frontieri reported it first, and Godfrey has confirmed it. The comet's course has changed. It's going to miss us. Dan, whatever you told them, it worked. You did it.
Dan looked at Clark, who was close enough to hear every word of the phone conversation. Clark wore a joyous expression, perfectly befitting a man who had just learned that his life, along with every other on Earth, had been spared. Dan, having taken the messengers at their word that they would ensure the comet didn't hit, was less emotional but no less relieved.
I think the credit for that has to go to them, he said.
Don't you sell yourself short, Dan McCarthy,
Emma replied, warming his heart with the chirpy tone of old.
Don't you ever sell yourself short.
Clark briefly glanced at the agent, sensed the man's impatience, and tapped his own wrist to pass the silent message to Dan.
I have to go, Dan told Emma.
Okay, I'll see you soon, she said. And Dan?
Yeah?
I love you.
Momentarily, Dan felt frozen once again, an altogether different kind of frozen than during his experience in the drive-in, but frozen nonetheless. I love you too, he eventually said.
The message is on point, but I think we could work on the timing and delivery,
Emma replied, putting on her best work voice. Dan couldn't help but laugh. I'll be there as soon as I can, he said, ending the call. The agent cleared his throat. So? Okay, Dan said, turning to face him. I'm ready for your questions.
C+44. Undisclosed location, 4 hours from Birchwood, Colorado. During the final stages of Dan's journey to the facility where he would undergo physical and psychological analysis, his anticipation grew. He had heard stories of secret facilities relating to alien research. Everyone with any interest in the subject knew these stories, and the fact that he was mere minutes away from walking inside such a facility saw anticipation conquer trepidation in his mind. To his disappointment, however, the vehicle was already parked inside a nondescript hangar when he was allowed to disembark. He scanned the area, seeing nothing but several large black SUVs. He now knew what kind of vehicle he'd been brought there in, at least, but there were frustratingly few clues as to where there was. In fact, there were none. And despite having cooperated fully with the agent's extensive and repetitive questioning during the drive, Dan's persistent questions about where they were going had been blanked at every turn. It quickly became clear to Dan that no one was going to tell him anything, but he would scarcely have believed that other than a few doctors, this single agent from the car, who insisted that the McCarthys call him Harris, would in fact turn out to be the only person they would see during their time inside the mysterious facility. Leading the way to the far side of the eerily vacant hangar, Harris took the brothers through an unmarked doorway which led immediately to a downward stairway. "What's down there?" Dan asked, reasonably enough. For the first time all day, a hint of a smile crossed Harris's face as he replied, "Everything. For over 70 years, this site has been home to researchers involved in the collation and evaluation of all supposedly extraterrestrial phenomena witnessed on Earth," he explained as he walked quickly down a long corridor. Keen to hear every word, Dan kept pace and pretty much stuck to Harris's hip while Clark followed behind. "But the implications of what happened today," Harris said, trailing off and pausing in thought. "Well, I don't think I have to tell you. Let's just strip away the dressing and get down to business here. Strip away the joyous relief about the comet, strip away the political feeding frenzy that's going to come out of all this hoax stuff, and strip away the fact that your life is never going to be the same again, okay? All of that, we'll put it over here in the corner while we focus on the meat of this thing. Earlier today, aliens walked on Earth. They arrived, they landed, they disembarked, they, for lack of a better term, telekinetically immobilized 3 people and penned hundreds more behind some kind of force field. I'm not going to lie to you guys. Part of me still feels like I'm going to wake up any second and realize that I dreamed the whole thing. I've been half expecting to wake up for the last year, Dan said, far more at ease with Harris now that they were out of the claustrophobic space in the back of the vehicle and conversing more openly. The folder, Lolo, Emma, I could never have imagined any of that being real. If I didn't have all the proof of Lolo in particular, I really think I might have doubted myself some days. Speaking of which, we will need you to hand everything over, Harris said. All of the footage, all of the documents, all of the everything. Can I keep copies? Dan asked. Harris chuckled and looked at Clark. He is an honest one, isn't he? Just like they say. He then turned back to Dan. Can you keep copies, officially? No. But pragmatically? Well, I'll leave it at that. We're going to need some serious proof of who you are before we give you anything, Clark insisted. I haven't even seen a badge since we got here. Of course, Harris said. Well, I won't be showing you any badges, but what you could do is hand all of your documents and evidence to any public official with the requisite clearance, and then you'll know that they'll only reach us if we're as legitimate as we say we are. Hell, you can hand it all to President Slater herself if that's what you want.
I want to see the research you guys have, too, Dan said, more in hope than expectation. Harris laughed, quite warmly. Prepare to be underwhelmed. But seriously, I won't lie to you, Dan. The physical exam you're about to undergo won't be very pleasant. I don't know everything, but I do know that a local anesthetic will be applied to the insertion point on the back of your neck prior to, well, analysis, and also that you can expect full-body, analysis. No way, Dan said, abruptly stopping in his tracks. Harris looked to Clark for support and was pleasantly surprised to receive some. I'll be at your side, man, Clark said. We'll get this over with and it'll be done forever. I know what full-body is code for, Dan complained at greatly elevated volume. Dan, Harris said as softly as he could. Hours ago, an alien being hooked you up to a bio-interface. These tests have to be carried out, and I can assure you that they will be as non-invasive as possible. And before you protest again, let me just say that they didn't send me along with you today to set up some good cop, bad cop kind of deal, okay? You and I have both lived lives motivated by a desire to prove precisely what you have just proven beyond all doubt. Truly, undeniably, we are not alone. And because I see something of myself in you, I don't want to say these words, but I feel like I have to. This is happening, Dan, and there really are only two ways it can be done. One is with your cooperation, and the other is despite your resistance. No choice, man, Clark whispered. Dan sighed. Once I do this, I can go inside any room I want? Deal? Harris placed his hand on Dan's back and prompted him to resume walking past the handful of locked doors on both sides of the subterranean corridor. There weren't all that many, but still enough to pique Dan's curiosity. Dan, once this is done, you can go in every room you want. Dan had previously undergone one full medical checkup in his life, and other than a few extra scans inside fancy-looking machines and a single painful procedure during which the insertion point on his neck was thoroughly examined with a variety of equipment he preferred not to look at, the one he underwent in this top-secret research facility was no more invasive. It helped slightly that Clark underwent most of the same procedures following his own temporary paralysis at the messenger's hands, procedures which the other police officer, who had also been immobilized after reaching for his firearm, had apparently undergone elsewhere. But Dan was on his own for some of them. "Why does this place even have all of that medical stuff?" he asked Harris when it was over and the psychological section of the analysis was about to begin. "For this very situation," Harris replied. "To analyze a verified contactee." Dan's expression changed at the sound of this word. "Have there been other contactees?" Harris shook his head. "I'll show you the archives after the psychological analysis and general questioning, but like I told you earlier, there isn't anything anywhere close to as exciting as what happened today. We have images of a craft that we firmly believe is either the exact one that landed in Birchwood today or is part of the same fleet. But we have nothing on a verified landing or any plausible stories of contact." In Lolo National Forest, during his first conversation with one of the messengers, Dan had been told that their small, uncloaked craft had indeed visited Earth on at least one previous occasion, but that they had never directly interacted with anyone. He wasn't surprised that Harris's archival data was consistent with this, but it did reassure him that Harris and his colleagues would likely have some other interesting images or data that he hadn't seen. Like a child in a restaurant, Dan sat down at a square table ready to force his way through the vegetables and get to the dessert. Only Clark and Harris were present with him in the room, but it didn't take a genius to realize that the mirrored wall was concealing direct observers on the other side. A lie detector sat in the center of the table, prompting Harris to tell Dan that this was also non-negotiable. Several other voices, audible through overhead speakers, then thanked Dan for cooperating. Dan didn't object to the lie detector, but he did object to the seemingly endless string of introductory questions unrelated to the aliens, which reminded him far too much of his experience with the psychiatrist who long ago misdiagnosed him with schizotypal personality disorder. Even Clark lost his cool and stepped in at one point when Dan's annoyance peaked after a particularly loaded question about their family history, telling the unseen questioners to skip all of this bullshit and get to the fucking point.
With encouragement from Harris, the rest of the bullshit was skipped, and Dan was then asked to talk freely about the events which had culminated in the messenger's ultimate decision, their eventual decision, to alter Comet Conte Abate's orbital path sufficiently to ensure that it would closely but safely pass Earth in just over 8 months' time. "I'll say the whole thing once and only once," Dan said. "You can ask whatever specific questions you want, but I'm not going to repeat the whole thing. Here goes, so listen up. Humanity launched DS-1 because of the two fake plaques that Walker hoaxed, remember that? The messengers then made a rare decision to intervene because the broader DS-1 project was eventually going to put nukes in space, and that wasn't something they were prepared to allow. With me so far?" Then, almost right away, they saw that their intervention caused chaos, since we all felt defenseless and exposed. So, because of that, they tried to reset everything by planting a third plaque that was consistent with the first two, the fake two, but which also let us know that the aliens we were all so worried about weren't actually hostile. That worked, and a year went by pretty smoothly. That brings us to the Kerguelen bolide. Dan paused for breath. When the messengers saw a comet coming, they decided to warn us about it so that we'd have a chance to save ourselves. Contact had been established, through me, so an intervention to show us the comet, through me, was deemed sufficiently minimal by the messengers' elders who make those calls. Events in California and Lolo, combined with a vision they showed me of a triangle in the sky over Lolo, led me to the plaque. The guys whose house we found the plaque at didn't know anything, and they still don't know anything more than everyone else does, but once again, the messengers put that fourth plaque somewhere that made sense in the context of the hoax. We found out that the plaque was a comet warning, and we gave the GSC and Timos people a chance to deal with it. We told the GSC immediately, but after nothing came out of the summit, I started to have serious doubts. And then, after what happened to Timo, it was pretty clear to me that we had no realistic chance of saving ourselves. Our only hope was for me to somehow get the messengers to come back. I thought that threatening to spill the hoax would bring them back, because with the way they went about planting the third plaque, they had shown that they knew exposing it would cause chaos, and I especially thought it would work since they intervened when Walker was going to spill it a few weeks ago. Obviously, that didn't exactly go to plan, and I ended up spilling the whole thing. But once the truth and the lies and the secret were all out, once humanity's view of them was no longer clouded by the hoax, the messenger's elders allowed them to come back to offer some technical information on how to protect ourselves from this comet. They didn't realize that the time frames involved were way beyond us, but the elders wouldn't let them carry out a hands-on intervention as big as influencing a comet's orbit, since something like that could have potentially major knock-on effects elsewhere. As you should already know, since I've already told all of this to Harris, I told them that their initial sabotaging of DS-1 last year was the main reason we couldn't defend ourselves today. And then, obviously, they took that point of view to their elders and got a green light. Did they feel guilty? Do they even know what guilt is? Do they have a moral imperative to undo harm once they know they've caused it? I don't know. All I know is that they wanted to help us, and they did. We're all sitting here trying to make sense of their setup with the so-called elders, of their rules about minimal necessary intervention, and of every other little thing. But how can we reasonably expect to make sense of this? This is humans trying to make sense of what aliens did while the aliens were trying to make sense of what humans were doing. They don't understand us perfectly, but they were trying their best. Just like I'm trying my best to understand all of this right now, and just like I'm trying my best to help you understand it too. But if you're going to ask me to try to give you anything more than the factual sequence of events I've just laid out, I don't know what to tell you. Clark nodded approvingly in support of Dan's relatively succinct rundown of a true story crazier than anything either of them could ever make up. I can confirm that this is exactly what Mr. McCarthy told me in the vehicle, Harris said, nodding along with Clark. Dan's rundown had certainly been a lot briefer than the one he'd given Harris, likely due in no small part to practice making perfect. At least three voices other than Harris's proceeded to ask Dan a series of easily answerable questions for the next hour or so, none accompanied by a name or any platitudinal remarks. Some of the questions were better than others, but some of those others, particularly towards the end, truly tested Dan's patience. "I wish you could just stick a damn cable in my neck and download my thoughts," he groaned after repeating the same thing for what felt like the dozenth time.
I've told you absolutely everything I asked the messengers and absolutely everything they told me, at least twice, and that's after I told Harris everything in the car. Do you people need me to write it down? Draw you a picture?
Clark put a hand on Dan's shoulder to try to calm him down.